And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, hello, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho, broadcasting from BBS Radio 1, and welcome to the show where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Carl Palmer is a drummer's drummer, a consummate professional, a brilliant technician, and a dynamic showman. He has thrilled listeners and audiences alike for nearly four decades with some of music's most memorable bands, including Atomic Rooster, The Crazy World of Arthur Brown, Asia, and, of course, Emerson, Lake & Palmer. Along the way, his dexterity, speed, and mastery of the drums combined with his infectious stage personality have secured for him a respected place in history as one of rock and roll's greatest drummers. At the age of 18, Carl joined up with the Crazy World of Arthur Brown at the absolute peak of their success following the smash single Fire. In 1969, Carl returned to the UK to form Atomic Rooster. It was with Atomic Rooster that Carl enjoyed his first real success as a founding member of a band. But it would be in the spring of 1970, Carl received a phone call that changed his life forever. Keyboard virtuoso Keith Emerson from the Nice was forming a new band with King Crimson founder Greg Lake. Immediately dubbed a supergroup by the media, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer entered the musical arena with great expectations. The classic single Lucky Man became a hit, and their stage show quickly became the stuff of legend. They recorded and released five albums in 4 years, all of which reached platinum status, among them Tarkus, Trilogy, and Brain Salad Surgery. An insane touring schedule followed, and the legendary scale and musicianship of ELP's live show continued to grow. Tired from a grueling four-year run, which had seen the release of five albums, as well as untold hundreds of tour dates, the band decided to take a hiatus. The material created during this period was the basis of the EL album Works Volume 1 and Works Volume 2, which were released back-to-back in 1977. The band continued to tour and record for two more years before disbanding in 1979. Opportunity knocked again for Carl when he was approached to form a supergroup concept for Geffen Records. Eventually, along with King Crimson vocalist bassist John Wetton, Yes Buggles keyboardist Jeff Downs, and Yes guitarist Steve Howe, Asia was born. The band's self-titled debut album, Asia, was released in 1982, and a tour began worldwide. Along the way, singles such as Heat of the Moment, Only Time Will Tell, Wildest Dreams, and Soul Survivor dominated the charts for months. In 85, Asia went their separate ways. Carl would spend the next 7 years playing in different combinations of bands with Keith Emerson and some of the Asia members. Finally, in 1992, ELP returned with Black Moon. They would remain together until 1998 and reform for one final appearance in London at the High Voltage Festival in 2010. To date, Carl has sold nearly 50 million records. In 2012, Carl was approached by the innovative art company Scene 4 to do a series of art images based on his rhythmic and musical ideas. The images are a unique blend of light, shadow, reflection, and musical performance related to his legacy. Carl is an avid collector of contemporary art and antiques from all over the world. His knowledge of contemporary art fueled his interest in pursuing his own art projects with Scene 4. To date, he has released two collections, Twist of the Wrist and The Rhythm of Light. Carl Palmer is returning to the U.S. for the second leg of the enormously successful 2016 Remembering Keith and the Music of Emerson, Lake & Palmer tour, originally designed to be a celebration of Palmer's 50th year in music. The focus and name of the tour was changed in light of the tragic death of Keith Emerson. Carl Palmer's ELP Legacy will play nearly 2 hours, and drum enthusiasts can expect an evening of compelling, persuasive skills, percussive skills, from the man who brought the drum set to the forefront of rock and roll music. It is my great pleasure to welcome legendary drummer and songwriter Carl Palmer to the Ray Shasho Show. Hello, Carl.
Hi, Ray. Listen, Ray, I don't want to stop you. Just keep reading. You're doing such a great job there. I'm going to send you some more information through. I mean, listen, you don't need me. You're doing such a great job, seriously.
Well, it's great to have you then.
Well, it's great to hear all that stuff. I had to take a shave in the middle of that because I had quite a lot of it before, but you read it well. I would suggest you might want to do this on a regular basis. It's good.
No problem. I think I will. Well, you got you're on tour and you're doing part tour of the tour. And how's the tour coming along?
Well, this is really the second half. You know, we started way back the end of May, June.
Right.
And you know, obviously it's a little bit sad because on this particular tour this year, Keith was going to join me. We started talking about playing together at the end of last year. And what he wanted to do was he wanted to get this year started. He wanted to get off to Japan. That was a concert tour he'd had booked sometime in May. And on his return, he was going to take a look at my itinerary, which by that time would have been completely filled up. And he was going to choose at least one and possibly two places to come out and play. Obviously, he never got to May even, because the tragedy happened on the 11th of March. So that was rather sad. But I just decided to turn it round and, you know, rename the tour, Remembering Keith. And, you know, we've kept it growing from there. There's a DVD which has been made now, which it's called Welcome Back, My Friends, Show That Never Ends. It was made on the 25th of June at the Olympia Theatre in Florida. It has Steve Hackett on guitar. He has joined my band just for that evening. I've got my two guys, Paul Bielikovic on lead guitar, Simon Fitzpatrick on the stick and on six-string bass. Hackett came on and played Fanfare and Nutrocker. Mark Stein, who Keith was a big fan of, from Vanilla Fudge, came on and sang Welcome Back, Knife Edge. We had a choir, which Keith and I talked about using, on a great piece of music called Jerusalem, which was a single which was banned by the BBC many years ago in England. So the Ida Choir sang on that. We also used a contemporary dance group on the piece by Mussorgsky, Pictures at an Exhibition, which was the ELP's kind of second album. In actual fact, their very first live album, Mussorgsky being a composer that both Keith and myself, you know, enjoyed immensely. So that's where that's gone. I've also done a canvas, a painting, using the LED light drumstick, which I play, and we capture this into a computer, and we get these various shadows and reflections and light, just as you spoke about earlier. And I've got that up on my site, carlpalmerart.com. People can see that, and I've just called that Welcome Back, My Friend, to the Show That Never Ends. So, you know, we've done what we can this year, and I'm just going to carry on the rest of this year doing what I can, and that will be it. And the funny thing is, the funny thing that's happened now is we've started looking at concerts for next year, and people are saying to me, well, we'd like to book you, Carl, but will you do the tribute show? And yes, I mean, of course I can do the tribute show. I don't want to sort of carry on doing it for the next 2 years, the tribute to Keith. I mean, I obviously respect and love him madly, and he was probably the greatest musician I've ever played with, but you know, there comes a time when I'll feel a bit strange, you know, keep on doing the tribute show. But we are at the moment, and we have some great footage of Keith, and we are going to carry it into next year. And how long I do it after that, I mean, I don't know. But up till now, it's been a lot of fun. It's been a little bit sad, obviously, but I'm only too pleased to do it for him and the family.
Well, the tour continues November 10th in New Jersey. You'll be in Asbury Park, New Jersey. Friday, November 11th in South Orange, New Jersey. You'll be at the Havana Club on the 12th in New Hope, Pennsylvania, Infinity Hall, Hartford, Connecticut, the Token Lounge, Westland, and the Ludlow Garage in Cincinnati, Ohio on the 16th, the Bright Box Theater in Winchester, Virginia on the 17th, and you'll be here in Florida at the Largo Cultural Center, which is now called the Central Park Performing Center, in Largo, Florida. Yes. That's only about an hour from me here. That'll be November 19th.
Does that mean you're coming, Ray? Because it's only an hour away.
It's only an hour away. I might, I'd like to come. I know all the people. I know Rob Mandora there, who books all the shows, and I've covered a lot of shows there. So, yeah, most likely I will be coming there, yeah.
We're looking forward to seeing you there, Ray. Don't let us down.
Thank you.
Come on. Step up and take the challenge, Ray. Get down there.
You got some new dates, too. You added Mexico November 29th, El Salvador San Salvador on December 2nd, and Panama City, Panama on December 3rd, and then I saw you had some German dates next year. Is that right?
Yeah, we're starting. We actually were going to start in England because obviously England wants a tribute show, and we were going to put one in the end of February, beginning of March, but
right.
It kind of went wrong with various people who were available, so I've had to postpone that until August next year. But I actually do kick off the 31st of March, and I'm in Germany from April the 1st right through. I finished up around about the 24th of April, I think, in Europe. I'm going through Germany, Austria, and Belgium and places like that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you're going to be a busy guy.
I always keep busy, Ray, because then it keeps me away from having to do interviews with people like you. No, I'm busy. No, I'm always busy, and I'm only too grateful to do the interview. I'm really pleased.
I know.
All up today, seriously.
You know, I'm so sorry about Keith. I interviewed Keith in the summer of 2014, and he sounded in great spirits. You know,
just to make it very clear to you, Ray, that this was a complete shock to everybody, the people that have worked with him, family, and I'm very close to his family, and probably Aaron Emerson will come along and play at my show that I'll do in England for him. This was something, I mean, when I say completely out of the blue, literally nobody had any idea, even the woman he was living with, so... Very, very sad and completely unexpected.
Yeah, they had just released Keith Emerson and Greg Lake live from Manticore Hall. He was just elected into the Hammond Hall of Fame, and he was honored for his 70th birthday tribute by South Shore Symphony Orchestra. We had talked about that. We talked about the spinning piano for a long time at California Jam. Such a lovely man, Keith.
Yes,
Keith was, you know?
Lovely man. Probably the greatest musician that I've ever played with as far as keyboards are concerned. I don't think there's anyone who's come up yet really to match him, you know, because he was a guy that could play a piano concerto and play it like he was a classical pianist. And then the next minute he could jump on top of the L100 Hammond and ride it across the stage and be the Jimi Hendrix of the keyboards. And then he would turn around and deal with the latest technology of all time. So he was a great all-rounder, a great musician, very good writer, and he was one hell of a tap dancer as well. No, I'm teasing. He was a great
tap dancer. But he had a good sense of humor. You know, I got my best friend committed suicide about 2 years ago, so I understand exactly what you're going through. There was no signs. You know, we both, you know, talked about what was bothering us in life, but, you know, I never knew that he would succumb to a suicide. I just didn't, you know.
Nobody seems to know these things.
They don't.
I mean, to be honest with you, it is knowledge, common knowledge now, that there was a problem with antidepressant sort of tablets which were being used and alcohol in Keith's case.
Right.
But so this is obviously toxic. And it's a bad combination. But, you know, Keith had been drinking all of his life. And, you know, he was always straight when he played. And he was one of those guys who just could drink moderately, but drink all of his life and every day type of thing. You know, now whether that means you're an alcoholic, I don't know. But all I know is that he could do what he did. He was having these antidepressant drugs for quite a while. We thought 7 years. We later found out it was 12. But I think probably what was more of a problem for him was the fact he was losing the use of his right hand wasn't
right
as well that he wanted it to, you know. And that was because basically an operation was wearing out, you know, was over 19 years old. And I think that obviously came into play. But who really knows? Nobody will ever, ever really know. We can only surmise and talk about the various areas. But, you know, I don't have any more idea than anyone else, to be honest.
Yeah, it's very, very sad. It really is. You started, I think one of your greatest influences is when you listened to the Time Out album. which came out in 59 by Dave Brubeck. And one of your heroes, I guess, was Joe Morello?
Yeah, well, that was my first sort of jazz album. I mean, it was one of the first jazz albums to actually sell a million copies here in America. I mean, thanks to Paul Desmond, who wrote the track Take Five. So for me, Eugene Wright and Paul Desmond and obviously Brubeck and Morello were just, they were just a very sort of, very cool quartet. They sounded very European to me.
Right.
The music was arranged. There was no just free-form blowing. It was all organized, and I just loved it. And it was, and my dad brought it home, and we just played it for days. We just played it for days.
Brubeck was amazing, wasn't he? He recorded studio albums from 1946, I think, up to like 2005. That's amazing.
Yeah, no, he did a lot. I mean, he kept that quartet together for roughly 15 years, and they were sensational. They were all just unbelievable players. And I do have to thank Joe Morello. I got inducted into the Modern Drummer Hall of Fame.
Congratulations.
In the 80s. Yeah, this is in the 80s, a long time ago now.
Yep.
And Joe was there to present me with the plaque and things, and that's where we met, and we got to practice together and things. So it was a marvelous moment. It was a dream come true, really.
You prefer organized music instead of free-form music. Does that mean like fusion? You rather not do fusion, or how does that work?
I can jam out with the best of them, you know.
Right.
But
right.
I do like the beginning. I do like an end, and I like to know, you know, when the traffic light is red or green, you know.
Right,
but
right,
for
right.
Me, it's okay blowing away, but at the end of the day, you know, that type of like absolute free-form music for me doesn't really cut the cake today. You know, you need to have that element in the music. It's vital you have that element, but you need construction. You need
right.
design, and that's what I relate to. And that first album, Out of Time, Time Out, is a prime album to see all of the jamming going on, all of the ad-libbing going on within a structure. And then there are these concrete arrangements where the band comes back in and plays like a unit. And I think that's an important element in music, playing like a unit, playing together. And to play a part, to play on your own, yes, it's valid too. But it has to be constructed. It has to be designed.
Before we go on, I got to tell you, Carl, you're probably one of the best drummers I've ever seen in my life. And it's amazing the way you play. It really, really is. I've chatted with Billy Cobham. We did a Skype interview, who I love as well. He's a great drummer. And I think he did more of, because I think the Spectrum album was more improvisation than anything structured. So,
actually, funny you mentioned Billy Cobham. I'm in the process now. He doesn't know it, but I'm in the process now of getting my agent to contact Billy Cobham. And I'm thinking that we've known each other for a long time because the Mars Vision Orchestra toured with the LP.
Right.
I've spoken to Billy many times, as you can imagine. I think they only did about five or six dates with us, the Mars Vision Orchestra. But I'm looking at seeing, I don't know if Billy's interested, he doesn't even know this yet, but I'm looking at seeing if we can put the two bands together and go out and tour as, you know, Palmer and Cobham, or Cobham and Palmer.
Oh, my gosh, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I'm seeing it because it hasn't been done for a long time. We've got two drummers have got their bands out touring together. So I'm hoping that we can organize that. As I say, you're the first to hear it. So Billy doesn't even know yet. He might not want to do it. But it is an idea I've just come up with. So I thought I'd mention it because you pulled his name out of the hat.
Yeah, you know, Billy's doing a lot of, you know, kind of shows like you do. You know, he was in Florida and he did a show there, but he doesn't tour constantly or anything. He does a lot of those clinics, you know, drum clinics and things like that. So he hell of a nice guy. I'm sure you do it in a heartbeat. And I'd love to see you and him do a drum battle.
only if you're there, Ray. That's the thing. You've got to step up and be there.
Well, you can count on me.
Okay, well that's good. Yeah, we'll mark you down for that one.
Well, one of your other heroes is Buddy Rich. I saw a Johnny Carson show with him and Ed Shaughnessy, you know, Johnny Carson's drummer, who is incredible. What a drummer Ed Shaughnessy was. And they did a drum battle, and I'm telling you, Ed Shaughnessy was right there with Buddy Rich. It was incredible.
I've seen that clip on YouTube. I know.
Did you see that?
Yes, of course. Is the Pope religious? Of course I've seen it. Come on. This is what I do. Yeah, of course I've seen it. It's fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah. You got a great story about Buddy Rich, because you met him when you were 16 years old, and then later played in his band, and he became friends with you later in life. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, there's an anthology out, which is available on my website. And the anthology covers everything I've done, from that, my stuff with ELP, my stuff with my first band, the Kingsies, my first recording, right through to the percussion concerto I recorded with the symphony orchestra, right through to playing with Buddy Rich's band in Ronnie Scott's club, and he announces me on the things. It's on the anthology album, and I played a track called Shawnee, and that was probably about 4 years, 3 years before he died.
It's amazing the way you met him when you were 16 and how he kind of invited you, right?
He was a very, very nice guy. I went to his hotel and said to reception, you know, I'd like to see Mr. Rich, please. They asked me if I knew him. I said, yes, I'm a friend. And, you know, I was kind of shaking. You know what you're like when you're young. You've got lots of lots of face. You've got, you know, you're incredibly upfront. And I figured, you know, he was a hero of mine. And I thought he was the very best at the time, and I still do today. And I figured, I must say hello. I got to meet him. You know, it's my only chance. I might never happen again. And as I was speaking to the guy behind reception, the lift doors opened behind me, and I heard the doors open. I turned around, and there he was standing. So I walked up to him and said, Mr. Rich, would you sign my album, please? He said, of course. Give it to me. You know, he signed it, and I said, I'm looking forward to seeing you play. And he asked me if I lived in the area. And he said, oh, yeah, come back and say hello later. So I did, and that's how it started.
It's amazing. It's fate, definitely fate, what happened
to
you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, basically, you know, I just needed to meet what I considered to be the best in the world. And I just, you know, it was important. And great man. I mean, obviously, there's lots of stories about Buddy Rich. And all I can tell you is he was the nicest person ever to me, and was always, you know, he came to gigs later on, and when Edison Lake and Palmer played Madison Square Garden, I sent a car to pick him up to come down and play. I don't think he liked the show too much. We went out for dinner after. He thought it was okay. Mm-hmm. I think he didn't like the jazz section that we played. He said the problem with the jazz section in Take a Pebble, you're all playing different styles. He said, you're not together. So I said, fine. I said, look, I'm with you. Whatever you say is right. Let's order some dessert, you know.
You know, Brits should be very proud of the progressive rock label, because they basically invented it and can call it their own.
Hang on, Ray, you know? Ray. Step back a bit. We did invent it. That's
definitely.
Look, you've got jazz and we've got prog rock.
Right.
So that's where it is, you know. It's as simple as that.
Sure.
And it started way back. Like, it's really, this that whole psychedelic period with having theater and the big show and strobe lights and all of that really started again with the Crazy World of Arthur Brown before Bowie did anything like that.
Exactly.
So that stuff, that rock and roll theater, painting your face, fire helmet, started in like 68 with Crazy World of Arthur Brown. So England has been very forthcoming in, you know, developing the art, and at the back of end of that, what happened in the 70s was the prog rock movement was formed.
Yeah, I've always loved prog rock. It's my favorite because it's very serious, intelligent. It awakens the soul to think and feel the essence of life and living. You know, it's serious music that makes you really, you know, feel life. You know, it's so different than pop and just basic rock music. I love it. To me, there's nothing like progressive rock music.
Fantastic. I'll send you the money now, Ray. Don't worry.
But I really mean that, and I think England should be very, very proud of what it's done.
Well, I mean, you know, it's just one of those things. I don't know why it started there. It was kind of a natural thing. I mean, basically, at that period of time, the early 70s, I think there was a lot of people who were into the electronics, to the new keyboard things.
Right.
During the 70s, there were more things developed for keyboards than there were for guitars. So what happened was the keyboard players started sort of experimenting. And, you know, they started experimenting in such a way, an intro to a piece of music was about 10 minutes long, you know.
Yeah.
They had all these new sounds, and things just developed from there, and it became quite involved, you know, and it was a marvelous sort of time. And, of course, Record companies had to go along with it. American right. radio loved it in the 70s, so that's why all the bands came over here. And possibly, if it wasn't for America, though it's an English art form, prog rock, if it wasn't for American radio, it probably wouldn't have stood the test of time, because American radio at least played this stuff all the time. I recall in the 70s, you could hear prog rock music at midday. WMMR in New York, Scott Mooney, you could hear midday, you could hear him playing it. You know, so it was considered an art form, and the American radio at that time was an art form. So
right.
it's very clever stuff, and it just worked hand in glove with what we were playing.
You know, and if it wasn't for the Brits, the blues would have died.
That's right. I mean, we just figured, you know, it was good to sort of have a go at what you guys did here and try and bring it back and play it better. And in some cases we did, and in a lot of cases we didn't, but we tried.
How similar is jazz to progressive rock? I know, you know, progressive rock, you know, a little bit of jazz, classical, but how close is progressive rock to jazz, do you think, or jazz fusion?
If you take that first Brubeck album,
right,
Fine Out, that was progressive jazz.
Yeah,
at the time, because it was structured. There were solos. You know, they were taking like little classical sort of influences. They were using different time signatures. So if you think about it, that was a major landmark mm-hmm. in the jazz world, and that was progressive. So basically, that same thing was just done again, and more exaggerated, with modern-day technology in the 70s when prog rock started. You know, so that's the parallel, really. There's a line between the two of them.
Who do you think was the band that, you know, brought prog rock kind of, you know, to the surface? Do you think it was basically the old jazz guys, or do you think it was maybe like the Beatles' Sergeant Pepper's album or something like that?
Yeah, look, Sergeant Pepper, without a doubt, was it. You know, was
right.
definitely the beginning of that. We all know that. But mm-hmm. if you go on to sort of then having, you know, the great players, the great shows, taking it a bit further by, you know, having a production that went with the music and presenting it, probably the early days of Emerson, Lake & Palmer here in America, when we were using the orchestra and things like that, probably
right.
that was like the turning and the uplifting of prog rock yet again, taking it to another level. So I would say, you know, that ELP, because of the classical adaptation and the way we kind of deliver the stuff, I mean, we could rock out or blues out or jazz out,
yeah.
like the best of them, but, you know, we had a different approach to, like, playing. We were keyboard-driven. We had a guy that sang like a choir boy. We had classical adaptations, but when we were ready to rock, we would rock our socks off. So the combination of all these elements really gave it a uniqueness, and I think that's what really pushed prog rock forward yet again, especially here in America. And it was coming from a three-piece band, a trio. It wasn't like the Cream, which were basically a blues-based group.
Right,
fantastic
right.
writers, fantastic players. We were just a different level, you know, different genre. And it was fantastic. It was a fantastic time. I would say ELP has a lot to account for you in that area.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing how a trio can sound like a whole symphony orchestra, you know, and that's
yeah.
what ELP accomplished, you know.
Right. Yeah, we did try.
Yeah. Were you happy with the success of Emerson, Lake & Palmer?
Emerson, Lake & Palmer were basically, they were in the A-League for about 3 years, maybe
mm-hmm.
4 years of their career. And then we slipped down to that kind of slightly lower level. I mean, it was never as big as Pink Floyd. It was never as big as Led Zeppelin. It was never as big as the Rolling Stones. It was definitely more time in the B section than we did in the A section. But for a very short period, those first four albums, those first 4 years, I think we actually had some really earth-shattering music, which is still the blueprint for today.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that we didn't have, we didn't have legs. We couldn't keep it going, that standard. We kept it going for a long time, but, you know, it didn't have legs. The first 8 years were great. The first 4 years were the most triumphant. And then after that, it started to slip a little. And the last time we played, which was 2010, High Voltage Festival,
right?
May 25th, or something, June 25th was the last date. And, you know, it was nice to do that. And unfortunately, I sort of had to, I was the one that said, I think we should stop, guys. You know, we don't sound as good as we used to. And it would have been okay if we sounded as good as we used to. I didn't expect it to be any better, but if you can't maintain a standard, I think it's just better you bow out nicely, you know. So I had to call it a day, and obviously that didn't go down well with the other guys, but I figured that ELP's music was so high standard, and when you listen to the recordings, it was so great. I just want people to have that dream. I never wanted them to see the band not playing up to 150%, you know.
I think, you know, Keith did mention that. He said that you would, you know, after the show, just take off in your car and just go home at the end there. And I think that's probably exactly what you're saying, that you weren't happy with the performance and you just wanted to call it a day at that point.
Yeah, I just, someone had to do it, Ray, and it was had to be me. I mean, that was the kind of position I played within the band.
Right.
They were obviously both incredibly creative people, probably more creative than myself. Musicianship-wise, we were all on the same level in what we did, so there was no problem there. But somebody had to be the kind of referee, as it were, and somebody had to say. I mean, Greg Laker was obviously extremely annoyed and wanted to carry on and do this and that. And I just thought, you know, I love these guys so much. I didn't want them to expose themselves. I wanted to do the best for us. Not the best for me, the best for us. And it was a case of, you know, pulling the curtain down and saying, hey, we've done it. Look, we had 16 years, not consecutive years, 8 years together of unbelievable success. The first 4 years, we had another 8 years of good success, maybe not as good as the first. But listen, if you can have 16 years in music, playing it at that high level, then, you know, you've got to cherish that. And really, that's the jewel in the crown, and that's what I want to be left with when I finally have to give up. You know, I don't want to.
Yeah.
I don't want people to ever think, you know, that I'm not playing to my fullest level at any time. Because when that happens, if I wasn't playing, even myself, if I was not playing at the level I want to play at, you wouldn't see me. I'd be gone. I mean, I had this thing that I always used to say in ELP. Guys, we should look at it like this. If we can carry on improving, let's stay together. You know, if we can't carry on improving, but we can maintain this very high standard, let's carry on doing it. If we can't maintain the standard, we got to go.
Yeah.
And that's how I think about it. And I treat myself exactly the same way. So that's what it's all about for me.
I think Ritchie Blackmore had the same attitude with Deep Purple at the end there, too. You know? He didn't want to continue anymore because the band was changing into a direction he didn't want, and it just wasn't the band he knew anymore.
Yeah.
Yep. Would you have done anything different with that ELP? Would you have liked to do anything?
I would have liked to have been. I should have been more forceful.
Right.
You know, there were times when we were doing things where I wasn't completely happy, but. You know, I thought, you know, I was kind of following the lead at times. You know, the orchestra, I wouldn't have done that the way we did it, you know, in hindsight.
Mm-hmm.
I would have come out first as a trio and got the orchestra to join us later, make the thing build. But Keith wanted to come out with a big bang right out of the box with the orchestra. But the problem was we'd been away for so long that people needed to see the original card trick, the three of us. Before the orchestra, that would have been better. And, you know, I was thinking that at the time. I didn't implement it because we came out with the orchestra because that's what Keith and Greg wanted to do. You know, and obviously I was there to support them. So, yeah, there's always things. But, you know, you can't cry over spilt milk. It's done, it's dusted, it's gone, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
Ray, it's been fantastic.
I talked to Greg Lake and I talked to Keith about California Jam.
Yes,
I always remember ELP because you guys headlined that what I thought was a great show on television. And
well,
me and Keith talked.
Be pedantic. It was a co-headline between Deep Purple and us. It was a co-headline.
But you guys, to me, stole the show. I mean, the performance was, you know, out of sight. It was fantastic. What are your thoughts on California Jam?
I can't really remember it, to tell you the truth. All I know, it went down pretty good. It was one of the biggest shows we ever did, and it was one of those major moments in our career. That's about all I could tell you on that.
Yeah. Keith went on and on about California Jam and the Flying Piano.
Flying Piano everybody knows about, it's pointless to be talking about that. I mean, that's been well documented and talked about. It was a great concert, you know, for all of those things. That's for sure.
Yeah. John Payne, who I've had on the show, he's got his version of Asia on the Road called Asia featuring John Payne. And now you guys are still together, right, with John Wetton?
No, as far as Asia is concerned, I wasn't going to be making this next album with Asia.
Oh, you're not?
No, I'm not making the next album.
Okay.
I had a difference of opinion in what we should play. Nevertheless, I said I would play the live concerts, if any live concerts come up. The writing procedure started. I was just a bit worried about the direction people were taking. It was getting a little bit middle of the road for me. I loved the band dearly. But since then, as you probably know, John Wetton has been seriously ill and he's not very well at the moment. So I would say that there's nothing sort of happening there at the moment. But I will be there to support him and do whatever I can, when the time comes. And, if he is ready to record, maybe I'll do something. But I have no plans at the moment. And I don't think there are any plans to record right now because of John's illness.
What, were you happy with the last album, Gravitas?
Gravitas. For me, it was getting a bit too middle of the road, as I said to you. A little bit soft, I thought. So that's where I am on it. And I had a complete concept, musical direction that I wanted to see if I could fulfill within the band, using the history from all of the four band members, what we'd done before, like ELP, the Buggles, Dean Jonabean in King Crimson, and Uriah Heep and Roxy Music and stuff. I was trying to put like a sort of a rock, Asia rock ancestry tree together and try and, let people know that, how different we were, and we were a great band as well called Asia, but where we'd all come from, because it was very important. I mean, bands like Foreigner and Journey, are sort of kind of bigger than whatever Asia was, but probably they didn't have quite the history that Asia had. So I considered this as something that we could exploit. We could exploit it musically. We did try doing it, but it didn't work 100% because we didn't have any recorded material. But I was kind of advocating that we sort of re-record things by ELP, re-record something by King Crimson, and probably record five new tracks as well, brand new tracks, and mix it up together and try and put like a historical type of prog rock come show together, Asia show together. And it seemed to be going down quite well. John wasn't super keen on it, but I never quite understood that because he'd already sang with other bands like District 97 in his past and things. So anyway, it's a bit confusing. So that's not happening at the moment, But he's getting better, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear he's getting better. Of course, Sam Coulson took over for Steve Howe on guitars, and that was the first album that he was featured on in Asia. I guess Steve retired from Asia, and he's strictly devoted to Yes now. Carl, here's a question that I ask everyone that I interview. If you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie Field of Dreams, to perform or collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
I would say singer Elvis Presley and on trumpet Miles Davis.
Really?
Yeah.
Were you a fan of Elvis's drummer? He was a pretty good drummer as well, right?
I said singer, Elvis Presley. I thought he was one of the greatest singers that America's ever produced. If you have seen him live, then you'd understand exactly what I'm talking about. One of the few guys who could sing a rock song like he would not believe, and the next minute turn around and sing the most unbelievable ballad. Great pitching, great timbre to the voice, unbelievable showman, and apart from his band being great, he was really just one of a kind.
Did you meet Elvis? Have you had a chance to meet him?
No, I went to his show. I went to two shows. I went to one in Lake Tahoe, one in Louisiana. All of ELP were all of ELP were Presley fans.
What year did you go see him in concert?
I went to see him in like 73, I think was the late Tahoe, and I think it was a couple of years later, just before he died or whenever he died, in Louisiana. So I saw him when he was mean and lean, and I saw him when he was kind of puffed up and a bit sort of bloated.
Yeah, I saw when I asked this question to Keith, he said maybe John Cage. He said a lot of guys from the jazz area like Coltrane and Miles Davis. I asked Jeff Downs. He said Sting. Billy Cobham said living now. He said Roy Haynes. He said in the past Elvin Jones, Buddy Rich, Louis Belson, and Mel Lewis. And Carmen Appice, who I've interviewed, he said Led Zeppelin. He liked to play with Zeppelin. I guess Bonham was his hero. Mm. So, I got a lot of interesting answers from that.
Right.
Yeah. What makes a great drum solo?
Well, I think the problem is that a drum solo starting in the first place is a problem, isn't it?
You
know. I can't tell you what makes a great one. We all know what makes a bad one, though, and that's the most important thing.
You were the first to change the drum sound and expanded kit to the steel synth kit, right? Like in Toccata.
Yes.
That was you.
Yeah, I'm big time, Ray. I mean, you're talking to the governor here. You know, I'm big time. What do you want me to tell you?
You're the pioneer.
You know, well, I mean, I have one of the very first recorded electronic drum solos, which was on Toccata.
Right.
Which is a piece by Ginastera, which is on the Brain Salad Surgery album. A lot of people thought it was all coming, these sounds were coming from the keyboard, but it was some electronic equipment I had made for me, and I was putting it through a mitigator, which was a pedal board that guitar players use, where I could change the sounds up an octave or down an octave. So I had 8 different sounds which could go up or down. So I put together an electronic drum solo, which happened in the center of middle of Toccata. And obviously it never achieved the acclaim that it should have done, but it was because it was so far above everybody's head. You know, nobody realized where it was coming from, and we didn't make a big deal of it. It was just another day in the shop for us. You know, that's how we looked at it.
Yeah. We're going to play a track from an ELP song here. I don't know which track it is because my engineer is going to play it. And right. I just wanted you to kind of comment on the song.
Right. Okay. How long have we got, Ray, together before we have to part?
Maybe 5 minutes.
Oh, okay, no problem at all. I just got some other stuff coming in. I want to give you everything you want, you know?
We'll make it fast. This is from the. Is this from the current tour?
Well, I don't know which one that is, what recording that is. I can't really tell. So, listening down the phone on my, down the telephone here, on my mobile. But that's on the tribute album I've made for Keith, and it's also on one of my albums. Yeah, so you know, that could be from anywhere. I'm not too sure.
Yeah, it's a great version of the classic ELP song. It really is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what's basically happened here? It's been quite a tough road because I've decided I would only really use guitars and not keyboards. Because, you know, playing with the greatest keyboard player in the world ever, Keith Emerson, I figured, you know, I'd just try and show how the ELP music, you know, could be transferred to other instruments and just show it in a different vein, a different way. You know, there are things we gain with guitars and there are things we lose with guitars. We couldn't have done this years ago because the guitar players just weren't good enough and
right.
The bass players weren't good enough, but now they are. So for me, it's been a great journey, and it just takes the music, I think, to a younger audience as well. They see it, you know, done in a different way. This is not what their parents listened to. This is what they can now listen to.
Right.
You know, this is bringing it forward. So for me, it's been a great, great experience. And I can tell you now, Ray, if at the very beginning ELP could have found a guitar player that was good enough, let's say like the guys that I've got, they would have been in the band, or he would have been in the band. We would have been a four-piece and not three. We just couldn't find anyone who could deliver on the standard. It's in the last 15, 20 years that guitar players have just taken over. I mean, if you think about it, you know more great guitar players than what you do keyboard players now.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So, I mean, that's just the way it's gone.
Who's in your band right now, and who's your current guitar player?
So my current guitar player has been there just over 10 years. It's Paul Bielatovich. And my bass player, who plays a six-string bass, and he plays the Chapman stick, 10 strings. The Chapman stick can generate synthesizer sounds, which we do, similar to those played by ELP. And he can play the bass at the same time. So it's a 10-stringed instrument. It's called a Chapman stick. And that's Simon Fitzpatrick. I also use quite a few sound bites in front of the songs, you know, just like you heard on that, the sequencer, that's the original sort of ELP type of sequencer. I've just changed it slightly. So we, you know, it's put together in such a way where I've got a lot of visual aspects sort of happening. The back of the stage, where I project a lot of film, which, you know, relates directly to the music. On this particular tour, Remembering Keith, I've got a few images of Keith up there at the poignant moments. And, you know, I'm very pleased with it all. It's all working really well.
Just real quick, I just want to talk about Carl Palmer and the Art of Giving, which is, I'm sure, very dear to your heart. Can you just kind of talk about that just for a second or two?
Yes, well, basically, I've been involved with a company called Scene 4 in Los Angeles, where I've created a lot of artwork through using LED drumsticks. So I've got these LED drumsticks where the actual tip of the stick, the tiny little bit at the end, the bit that plays on the cymbal or the drum, is actually a light, an LED light. And they're indestructible. There's four colors, yellow, green, red, and blue. And they're self-generating. When you pick them up, you can play, right, the drums. And you can play full out, full on. You know, you don't have to hold back. You can crash cymbals. You could do whatever you want to do, and these lights stay on. So I was experimenting way back in 73, by taping light bulbs to my drumsticks with a cable going down to a battery, and I would pretend to mime the drums, and, you know, I'd catch all these arcs of light and different things that were going on. I thought, wow, wouldn't it be great if people made drumsticks, you know, that you could actually play the drums, because I wasn't playing in 73. I was just kind of miming. But I had a picture taken of me doing it, and it made the local paper. It was like a big deal. So if you roll forward like over 40 years, they now develop these sticks that you can play the drums with. They're self-generating when you pick them up. You could choose two different colors, actually one in each hand, obviously. And I tried playing pieces of music like Tarkus, or playing something from Tank, or something from Pictures at an Exhibition, and trying to record the movement of light and how it all worked. And how I do that is in a very dark room, about 12-foot square, and I have one guy with two cameras set at different shutter speeds. And we film, and we might spend 7 hours and get absolutely nothing. But then you'll get something which is absolutely sensational, and you'll see a slight silhouette of me. You'll see absolute distribution of light and shadow and color. Very, very organized. It's just that, you know, one of those things that happen. You just don't know why it does, but you can just get it. You can spend all day, you get nothing. Anyway, I started to make pieces of art. out of this. And I've just done one for Keith. I've called him Welcome Back, My Friend, to the show that never ends. I've filmed it. I've got it down on the computer, and it's now on the canvas. I've now printed it off, and we sell them. So what I do is every time I sell any of my art, mm-hmm. I make sure that a third or just over a third goes to a charity. And so far, I've sponsored things like Camp Good Days. That's for children here in Rochester that have been used and abused or whatever.
Wonderful.
Teenager Cancer Trust. There's a whole host of them. And they all appear in, I've produced an art book, The Rhythm of Light. And all of the charities that we've donated to, the Cancer Trust of America, and things like that, they're all in there. So I've made sure that, because this artwork, this art form is of our time. It's, you know, due to people like you and I who have been involved with music or developed new products, developed new cameras, new programs for computers, have enabled me to bring this artwork, this art idea from 73 right up to today, where you can actually see this now. And it becomes an art form because it's something which is available only now because we've got the technology. So I thought it was only the right thing just to share it with people who were needy, who, you know, should get some benefit from this as well. So that's how it came about. And I work closely with a company called Scene 4 in Los Angeles. And we've been doing incredibly well. And I've got an art event coming up in a few days. In actual fact, I've had it in the galleries and places like that. But I've actually got an art event coming up with a dentist friend, somebody who I met on a cruise, who's going to put this art event up in a gallery across the road from his house. And we're going to have a lot of his friends there, doctors, lawyers, and, you know, ELP fans, whoever they are, coming along. And I'm there, and I talk about the art, explain via a DVD how it's all made. And there it's for sale, you know. And as I say, you know, whatever gets sold, a portion of that goes straight to the charity of the doctor's choice, you know.
Right.
I always let the people who are helping me with the event choose a charity, you know.
That's beautiful, Carl. It really is. And I did look at your website and one of the other charity organizations, of course, was St. Jude's Hospital, which I'm a big, you know, big fan of.
There's been so many of them, to tell you the truth, right? So many of them. It's been fantastic. And it's always nice presenting them with a check. I mean, the check, you know, might be like $3,000, $4,000. It might be $1,500. But it doesn't matter, you know, as long as they get something out of it, too. And just to be able to keep on doing that, it's just a real good sort of mindset for me to be in, because I kind of feel good about that, you know.
Everyone can view your artwork at www.carlpalmerart.com. And for all things Carl Palmer, you can visit www.carlpalmer.com. Carl, anything else you want to promote?
I just want to tell you, Ray, I want to thank you for having me on your show, and I hope in the near future we can get back together and talk again. It'd be a great pleasure, and I just thank you for playing the music.
Carl, thank you so much. You're a great man. We appreciate all you do, and looking forward to a lot more music in the future. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Ray, and stay well, and I hope to speak to you soon. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye now. Very special thanks to Bruce Pilato, manager of Carl Palmer's ELP Legacy, and to Doug and Don Newsom with BBS Radio for making it all happen every show. Join me bi-weekly Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on The Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on The Ray Shasho Show, call 941-877-1552 or email us at ray@publicityworksagency.com. Don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and the Wacky Family Business, or the second edition entitled Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to Be Politically Incorrect in Washington, D.C., available now at Amazon.com. You'll live it. Let's see if we can end this show with another ELP classic, Hoedown. Have a great week, everybody.
Hoedown! We'll be right back.
everybody, for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com. Specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on PBS Radio Station 1.